Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Mad Virginia, and it's about a play as part of the Pittsburgh Original Short Play series, correct?
Correct.
Correct, and our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about Mad Virginia, Miss Jeanette Schaefer. Hey.
Hello.
So let's get right in. Tell us about the Pittsburgh. Why don't we talk about the Pittsburgh Original Short Play series first, and then we will go dial into the plays.
Sure.
Plays, well, playwriting, and, you know, whatever the hell is going on right
okay.
now.
Okay. Well, the Pittsburgh Original Short Play series is hosted by Yin's Like Plays, which is a local production company that seems to really like awesome, affordable, local, do-it-yourself theater.
Nice.
And so that really resonates with me. And I think I'd also be remiss if I didn't mention the other playwrights. Tori Bovolino, and their play is Zway. And then Fasha and Feliz, Oceanic Love Letters. And Dan Ivek and Luke Niebler, their play is Christmas in July.
Luke Niebler!
Yeah.
Luke Niebler has been on the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay. I thought the name was familiar.
And that's so funny because he's on his Instagram has been like posting pictures of like bloody gauze and kind of leatherware. And he's like, don't worry, it's for a Christmas play.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
So, I'm looking forward to seeing everyone else's plays, and I feel like
Nibs.
This play has been my whole life for the past 6 weeks, and two absolutely fantastic actresses are playing Virginia, Mad Virginia in this play is Virginia Woolf. This play is the last, basically the last half hour of her life when she decides to commit suicide. And Virginia Woolf is being played by Samantha Storykamp, a really wonderful local actress that I've known for 20 years. And the other character is her mental illness, which I wrote as its own character, and that is being played by Janine Pierce.
Oh, wow.
And she is also incredible. And the two are excellent foils for each other.
Mm.
And we really take the time to explore how Virginia Woolf's mental illness both drove her creatively, but then also stifled her creatively, and the ways she embraced it, and then the ways that she abhorred it.
Mm.
So it's a comedy with dancing girls, not really.
Wow, that's gnarly. It's funny. Where do you go from there? Where do you start with? There's a couple angles in. I think one, well, I guess so as a playwright, like what does it mean to write a play with a main character who was a real person? And a famous person, an important person, a person that people have. For some people, I know for me, like, To the Lighthouse was a book that fundamentally changed me as a human being. It was the book I absolutely needed at that moment in my life.
Mm-hmm. And for me, it was A Room of One's Own.
Room of One's Own, yes. Which I've taught, and people, you know, when explaining what happened to Virginia Woolf,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, just couldn't.
And then in the 90s, the movie Orlando came out.
Yes.
Which just, she was so far ahead of her time exploring the gender identity question. 60 years before, you know, well, actually 80 years before it became a mainstream question.
Yeah.
And she was, Virginia Woolf was very far ahead of her time in so many ways that as time goes on, and I reread her works that were important and informative to me, I appreciate that more and more as time. Authors don't hold up well for me, like John Knowles. I reread a separate piece and I was like, but but Virginia Woolf, she has held up for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel you. I mean, every fall or late summer, I was getting, oh, God, it's going to happen again. I'm going to go teach school. And, like, I always, like, for some reason, for me, yeah, the Beat Generation is bass. But a lot of bad work. A lot of, like, stuff just does not...
Like, I love Howl, and that's always held up for me.
Yeah, Ginsberg,
but
yeah.
I pulled out On the Road Again, and I was like,
yeah, that's Kerouac. Yeah.
God, no!
Yeah. But, you know, Virginia Woolf's still with us. Virginia Woolf's going to still be with us for a while. I mean, especially, you know, for me, To the Lighthouse, the way that she explores the rich interior lives of people, you know, which is... But, yeah, I mean, what does that mean to take someone... Like, you're writing a play about Virginia Woolf. People are going to know who Virginia Woolf is.
Right.
People are going to say, hey, To the Lighthouse changed me fundamentally as a human.
Right.
Like, what's that like? What's that creative process like? Because I know, like, in a lot of your poetry, it is very autobiographical. You are exploring your own experiences. What does it mean?
Well, I guess in a way, this was sort of my love letter to Virginia Woolf, the writer who made me want to be a writer. When I was in my teen years and I discovered her and I discovered A Room of One's Own and started the way she, well, a lot of A Room of One's Own, she took from her own, a lot of it is from her own personal diaries. You know, some of the, diary writings that she quotes in there are back from when she was 15 and 16. And so, especially when I discovered that as like a 16-year-old girl, like I felt it everywhere and I was like, yeah, that's the kind of writer I want to be. And yeah, I need to, you know, I don't have a room of my own. I don't have, you know, a studio or anything like that, but I can carve out my own time. I can make my own sacred time. And, as a result, writing is probably the only thing I have ever been, disciplined about.
Yeah.
And, but I just sort of tried to imagine, so you have somebody who is, probably undiagnosed bipolar or undiagnosed borderline personality disorder, depends on which mental health professional you ask what they think she had. They didn't have the, science behind psychology that they do today, and they certainly didn't have a lot of the psychotropic medicine that makes people functional that they have today. And so you have this woman who's incredibly bright, incredibly talented, and now her mental illness has gotten to the point where she is no longer able to tap into her main coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And she's no longer able to tap into the thing that has given her life value and meaning and has been able to sustain her through these long bouts of separating from reality. She came from a background where both of her half-brothers, who were her guardians along with her father, were also sexually abusing her systemically. Mm-hmm. And... her mother died very young. Her sister died when she was young. Her father died also when she was young. And then she had her two half-brothers serially raping her.
Yeah.
So she gets to the end of her life. And she couldn't, not only could she not write properly anymore, she couldn't read properly anymore. And World War II... is really what sort of set her off on her last psychotic break.
Yeah.
And she found herself really transfixed by the radio shows. And so when I approached this play, I tried to imagine it as just, if I had a mental illness, what would I want to say to it? And then also approached it from an angle of what would it have been to overhear that conversation? Yeah. And what would it have been like to be a fly on the wall?
Yeah.
In those moments when she decided the best thing to do, not only for my writing and for my legacy and for my husband, is to end my life.
Yeah.
So I answered in a giant circle.
Yes. No, that is... And I guess for me, like, I'm thinking about all these, like, sort of philosophical issues mm-hmm. of...
And I include the entirety of her suicide note in the play.
Mm.
It's if you're going to write a suicide note, you know, if you're going to reenact her suicide, then you kind of have to have the note.
Yeah. You know, and just thinking about, for me too, it's like also this sticky issue that you're taking head on. This way that we think about genius in our culture,
mm-hmm.
and that the idea of the tortured genius and genius and madness and...
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's weird because I think, you know, I very much grew up, you know, the kid of the 90s, you know, and like grunge rock and Eddie Vedder's Yarl, you know, and you know, Yarl because you're pain and sensitive and that's where the art comes from, you know, and like, I don't know what to do with that model anymore. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if that model's aged well, but then there is this very real fine line that people dance.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think about it, you know, okay, what do you do with the psychology of it? What do you also do with people, you know, who don't know comfort? Is comfort the enemy of creativity? Or is it, you know what I mean? Like, people have had to build, who've had to make a life or had to try to figure things out. Are they almost in a weird, they're at this life disadvantage, but a creative sort of advantage because like complacency and home are not an option,
right?
You know, and I don't know what to do with that. As I'm thinking about my own life and my own my own traumas and whatever, and like I do the things that I do, and I know, you know, so many creative, interesting people
mm-hmm.
who've really made stuff, done stuff, were stuff, for whom, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do with that? Because that's sticky, you know, because you don't want to be like, you know, no, be crazy, chop your, I was just in the Carnegie Museum, like, this afternoon, right? You know, chop your ear off, it's cool, you know, yeah. That's what the great artists do. You know, they die penniless and earless, and that's, no, but yes, mm-hmm. but...
And like a lot of the writers that I grew to really embrace and whose work that I just tried to soak up when I was a young person and starting to read stuff beyond like, you know, the Babysitter's Club and that sort of thing. Mm. They all had these really... it seems like there's very few writers I know of either in... antiquity or modern day that don't have some kind of fucked up element to their life.
Yeah.
You know, like F. Scott Fitzgerald drank himself to death. Dylan Thomas also drank himself to death. Virginia Woolf kills herself.
I share a birthday boy. I share a birthday with fucking Hemingway.
Oh, yeah. You do, now that I think about it.
Ew.
Also killed himself.
Yeah.
And his famous quote is, if you want to know how to, I'm going to paraphrase it, I'm going to totally butcher it, but the best way to write is to sit at the typewriter and bleed.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines. I know I'm getting it wrong, but yeah. Hunter S. Thompson also killed himself.
I mean, I think about, you know, Eugene O'Neill tried to kill himself while writing Long Day's Journey into Night, which mm-hmm. is, I guess, was his most autobiographical
And it's play. A brilliant play. Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah.
Yeah, and or they just had, or, you know, Anais Nin had a consensual sexual relationship with her biological father. I mean,
yeah,
just some really screwed up stuff. And, yeah. And I won't get too, you know, if anybody wants to know about my life, just read my poetry for an hour and it'll pretty much tell you what you need to know. And it's very rare that I meet a writer who's like, yeah, my parents are still married. They've been married for 33 years and everything's great and hunky-dory and I have a job I love and I'm completely functional. I decided to sit down one day and write stuff.
Yeah, and so And I guess, you know, you don't want to romanticize that shit either. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard because you don't want to be like, well, you know, you got to be tortured, you know, like, you know, all the young kids in the MFA program, they need to start putting lit cigarettes out on your face, you know? Yeah. And then you're right. You know, you know, don't want that either. And I think we certainly, to harp on something you said earlier, we know so much more about mental illness now than even, you know, I think even more, and we're more aware as a culture and more compassionate as a culture, certainly than we were 20 years ago.
Right. And one of my actresses, she said something rather brilliant during a rehearsal one night. It was Samantha, said that sometimes you see a rash of suicides because suddenly something you didn't realize was an option is now on the table.
Yeah.
And like if you think of, is it Goethe who wrote The Sorrows of Young Werther? But they actually called it the Werther syndrome, because after that book came out in the 19th century, I believe it was 18th or 19th century, it really resonated with a lot of young men. And at the end of it, when his love life doesn't work out the way he wants it to, he ends his life. And a lot of young men who read that book ended their life.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so, obviously not all of them, but...
Not all of them, but...
But enough that they actually named a syndrome after it, the Werther syndrome, where you're affected by a piece of, I guess, pop culture, for lack of a better term, and it causes you to have some sort of psychological breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, well, again, our generation, you know, it was Cobain, and you know, and then now
it was
a
rash of suicides after Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, and of course, I think this week was the 1 year anniversary of the dude from Linkin Park, and you know what I mean. Yeah. And this, like, this, which I mean, affected people, and certainly Chris Cornell for also my generation affected a lot of people, and it's like, I think. And we really like to pathologize in our culture. We really like that pathologizing. Like, there's compassion. There's more compassion and awareness for mental illness. But also this really strong compulsion to pathologize everything.
Yeah.
And which is also not terribly compassionate or humane or, you know. And I think that's such a tough thing. And I think for people, you know, I think about actually the Tony Bennett line from the Amy Winehouse documentary, you know, life will teach you how to live it if you give yourself enough time.
Yes. Oh,
and
wow.
And I mean, it comes like right at the end of the documentary, as he's, you know, talking about Amy Winehouse and how great she was and how much greater she could have been, and for him the tragedy is being knowing that you have all these years.
And I have to double check it, but I think today is actually the anniversary of her death, because I was looking at my Facebook memories today and I had, and one of my Facebook memories from today was saying just heard Amy Winehouse had passed away, and it's really too bad because she's she had such a remarkable voice. But that's so creepy.
That is creepy. But, you know, and again, that was another figure that fits so comfortably in this narrative. Oh, well, she was crazy and beautiful. That's why. And that's why she was able to create what she did, because she had all of these terrible problems, which, again, I don't know.
Yeah. And when
how
I think
fair
of,
that is. Yeah. You know, it's hard. It's a hard thing in my mind that I'm trying to come to terms with, and you've dropped in my lap. Well, what's the play
You're
about?
Welcome.
Yeah. So, what's your play about, Jeanette? And then it's just like, you know, well, now you got the great contradiction of the human experience and Gen X and everything.
Oh, yeah.
So, here we are. And how do we dig ourselves out of this Mariana's Trench?
We'll circle back to Virginia Woolf here. And
yes, please do.
And I kind of want to give props to her husband, Leonard, in that she lived back in the day when any male relative had the legal right to commit any woman in their family.
Yeah.
So if a husband was cheating on their wife and the wife's getting in the way of the new life he wants to have, he can have her committed.
Yeah.
And same thing, your mom's getting in the way of the inheritance you want to collect, you have her committed. And he deeply loved Virginia. And I think in many ways, when people study her life, he ends up sort of the unsung hero because he... I mean, yes, she was hospitalized a few times, and, and he would do that when she was genuinely a danger to herself, but he was completely supportive of her and always made sure that she had space to write, and was incredibly supportive of her career. They had sort of a atypical marriage at that, you know, it was very unusual at that time, like in the 30s, 40s, to have an open marriage where both partners are openly bisexual. They were part of the Bloomsbury group, which were, you know, zany, intellectual, free love, free thinker types. And her suicide note was written to him, and in some ways you sort of felt like she was doing this as a sacrificial act, like, you know, you've given up so much of your writing so that I can do my writing, and now you can write again. So, yeah. Good times.
Good times, yeah. Good times, wow. Yeah, no, that's heavy, and yeah, that's still going to work in my head for a long time, you know, because, and, you know, we think about, too, you know, Virginia Woolf being abused, and, you know, we think about, now, I've heard this, I've heard this defense of, especially, let's face it, shitty white men who were creative, who did things people liked. Who perhaps even ones who have harmed other people. Well, that's genius and madness, you know? You got to take the good with the bad.
Which, like, I have such a love-hate relationship with John Lennon.
Yeah.
Like, I am such a huge Beatles fan. I think he was arguably one of the best songwriters of the 21st century.
And
20th, yes. Thank you. 20th century. And we're now in the 21st. He was in the 20th.
Okay. Yes.
But, you know, brilliant lyricist. Some of my favorite songs, you know, that have been the soundtrack of my life have been written by John Lennon. But he was a wife beater. He abandoned his first wife and child. Once he shacked up with Yoko Ono, he had very little contact with his son Julian ever again. Sean Lennon has said that, you know, he beat on Yoko and him, and and he was kind of an absolute horror of a human being with this absolute genius creative spark.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is hard to reconcile, you know, it's almost like love the art, not the artist. Hate the sin, hate not the sinner, kind of. Thing, you know?
Yeah, but it's hard. It's hard, especially, well, you know, it's John Lennon to say because he's dead, you know? Like, what do you do if he's still alive, you know?
Yeah.
And still... Yeah. It's just hard. I mean, it is, this is a hard thing, and I guess for me, yeah, it's like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, what do you do with all of these people? Michael Jackson, you know?
Exactly. Gandhi liked teenage girls.
Yeah, and it's like... In some ways, I guess for me, that's my struggle, is that myth can then be incredibly... That can be a sword used by apologists
to
defend absolute abject shittiness.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's, you know? And it's easy to do in your own life. When you get enough space from something, it's so easy to begin to idealize it, and for instance, like Virginia Woolf was anti-Semitic until they did some genealogical work and figured out that Leonard, her husband, was a quarter Jewish.
Yeah.
And then she wasn't anti-Semitic anymore.
Yeah.
And whoops.
Yeah, oops. And, you know, people change. People have the potential to grow. Right. I guess for me, is it like when somebody's still alive and they're shitty, you know, where do you get back? What does retribution look like? Mm-hmm. If retribution's possible?
Right.
You know, what do you do with... What do you do with then, also, if that's the case, victims still being alive?
Right.
You know, and I think we are, you think about it, we are openly in our culture, after a couple of centuries of just looking the other way and almost romanticizing the torture genius, mm-hmm. we are now finally in a moment where maybe we are ready to try to hash this out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody has easy answers, but we are willing to have that dialogue. Finally.
I know.
You know. And yeah, especially, you know, after decades, centuries, mm-hmm. millennia of shitty white men just kind yeah. of getting a pass because
and then not
they
to,
did something remarkable.
And then not to take too far a spin into the political, if there's any good that is coming out of the Trump presidency is that people are talking about, you know, people have these really shitty viewpoints that are not okay.
Yeah.
People who were in the closet about their racism are now out of the closet, and now we know who they are.
Yeah.
And people are talking about topics that normally were taboo, like, you know what? Guess what? I was raped.
Yeah.
Guess what? This person who was in a position of authority said this really horrible thing.
Yeah.
You know, and consistently says these yeah. really horrible things or engages in these really aberrant behaviors.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing I'll never forgive this region for mm-hmm. is, you know, I had two students who were waitresses at a defunct Northside sports bar, and they relate to me some pretty harrowing experiences that they had when a certain NFL quarterback, who's famous and beloved in this region where everyone has looked the other way for mm-hmm. because he was, I think we can now say in past tense, a really good quarterback, and just decided, well, I mean, he was only accused publicly 3 times and never went to jail.
Right.
So, you know, like, that for me is maddening. Like, you know, mm-hmm. September to February is utterly maddening for me because mm-hmm. of that. And I think about my two students, former students, who had these awful experiences who probably have to live with if they're still in the region. Mm-hmm. You know, seeing that guy in a car dealership commercial after a decade.
Ugh.
Suddenly weaseling his way back into, like, hey, I can be on TV when this is over if the 8 concussions haven't completely scrambled my brain.
Right.
You know. Yeah, fuck that guy.
Exactly.
Fuck that guy and fuck that fan base of apologists who... Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry. Yes. Sorry. That's the other... I mean, that percolates in me, too, thinking mm-hmm. about that.
So
what's it mean to have other people bring your work to life? Now, are you directing this? Are you, how's this work?
Well, actually, Garth, my husband, is directing.
Okay, your husband is directing this. Okay, even more complicated in many ways. Yes.
Well, he's a very gifted actor and director. I tend to think that playwrights shouldn't write their own work because I've had 3 occasions where... directors brought out in my piece stuff I didn't even realize that I wrote.
Death of the author, Roland Barthes.
And it's so delicious.
He's right there
on
the shelf. He's right there on the shelf. You're dead. You're done.
Yeah.
It's over for you.
Exactly. And it's such a delicious experience when that happens. But, you know, as somebody who's an actress and then, you know, I'm also, I guess I'm primarily known as a poet and I read my work a lot. And I don't get nervous when I'm acting. I don't get nervous when I'm reading my poetry. I am an absolute frickin' wreck when I'm watching actors perform my work. And like, because there's,
you have nothing to
this,
do.
Well, that, and there's, I think what it is there's this total lack of control. It's like someone is playing with your baby and throwing it up in the air, and you just hope that they catch your baby and don't let it like splat on the floor and die, you know, of a head injury. But,
Ooh, vivid.
but anytime, you know, this is the, fourth time something, this is the fourth play that I've had, produced. Mm-hmm. And every single time, literally, I'm sitting in the audience, my head is pounding, my hands are shaking, I'm pouring sweat like I'm in a sauna. And I just, you know, I'm like, because I can't, whatever they do is whatever, you know, however they portray it is what the audience is going to think about what I wrote. And I have zero control over what they're doing on stage. Zippity-doo-dah. And so, like, the writing process, that's...
singular. That's personal. Yeah. That is intimate. That is alone.
Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes my husband and I sometimes have issues regarding this, but writing is a very solitary activity.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I can write in a group setting, like if it's a workshop or that mm-hmm. sort of thing. But
even then, you know that it's you go away.
I go away, and I've got to finesse whatever it is. And I do my best writing between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. Monday through Friday before I go to work.
Mm.
And so, and as I mentioned earlier, writing is the only thing I think in my entire life that I've ever been really disciplined and regimented about. The rest of the time, I'm just kind of freeballing it and yeah. letting the chips fall where they may and flying yeah. by the seat of my pants. And but never about writing. Writing, I'm always like, you know, a good little soldier, you know.
Yeah.
And but yeah, there's that sense of. With a play.
The death of the author probably hurts. I mean, you yeah. probably, it's like, it probably feels like getting hit by a laundry truck.
A bit, you know, like, and especially the first time one of my plays got produced, I was completely unprepared for that reaction. I sat up from my theater seat and I turned around and it was literally wet.
Really?
I had sweat through my clothes. You could see like an outline of my ass in the chair because I had been sweating so much. I can't believe I just said that out loud
in yeah, public form. And but, it's into a microphone and the internet might... the internet's not forever.
Yeah.
But...
Maybe. It could be.
No, but, it's not.
But yeah, like...
This is going to go out there. This is going to be on iTunes, you know.
I know.
Maybe
I know.
Even Spotify.
I just admitted that to iTunes. But
potentially Spotify, too.
Yeah. But yeah...
Which reminds me, I need to just do that tomorrow. Anyway, submit to Spotify tomorrow.
But
yes.
Yeah, you have that whole... You write the play, but then after that, it is never yours again.
Yeah. It lives. You know, there's that great Ellen Diamond quote, mm-hmm. you know, when she talks about modern drama is that the past always needs blood donors.
Mm-hmm.
And those actors are your blood donors.
Yeah.
That they literally give their blood and their embodiment to bring this thing that is past tense.
Mm-hmm.
If you're done with it, you wrote it, it's over.
Yeah.
To life. And certainly,
it's not
as
like
she's talking, Ellen Diamond talking about historical drama and especially modern drama, which is very reflective as a medium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the blood donors are doing stuff. You know?
Yeah. And
maybe they're vampires.
Maybe actors are vampires.
Maybe they are.
But
sucking off your corpse. You know.
But fortunately I have some damn good blood donors for this particular project and I like that they're surprising themselves. I think it's been a bit therapeutic even for them to kinda explore this aspect of mental illness in a dramatic setting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's probably even some safety in that too, because you're exploring yeah. these very dark, very taboo subjects from a perspective of I get to be someone else but go there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, though. part of the lore of theater at St. Francis is when I had acting with, I talk about Kenny Rosinski a lot on this podcast, in the fall of 1995, thinking that's peak Gen X, right? Mm-hmm. College freshman in 95. I had acting. I just, they threw me like a babe, naked into the world.
Into a neophyte.
Into a 300 level acting course. And I just was not ready for that experience at all.
But you're a man and they need those in acting classes.
Yes. But, you know, we were talking about method acting and we're talking about embodiment. And there was this great story that Mr. Rosinski, the theater professor, said about he was in a play when he was a grad student. He was part of a production, I should say, when he was a grad student at Villanova. And there was a scene where the phone was supposed to ring. And the person was supposed to pick up the phone and go, uh-huh, boom, so-and-so, something for the plot was the next line. And that was their way of, that was the script's way of inserting this important plot information into the, you know, somebody died or something, you know. Someone's fled for the coast or, you know, whatever. And the phone rang, and the phone rang, and the phone rang. And they never picked up. And so they eventually just stopped with the cue, and then the lines went on. And in intermission, they were like, you know, whatever the person was, Marty, for fuck's sake, why didn't you pick up the phone? And he said, so-and-so character's name wouldn't have picked up the phone at that moment.
But it's... Oh.
Oh, God. And they had to scramble. They had to scramble to come up with lines in the intermission to get this important plot information into the play. So there's that story. And then there's the story of Richard III. They had, this guy was, I guess, like a business major, and he had very straight-laced and straightforward, and they, back in those days when they did a major Shakespeare, you cast Richard III and Hamlet and whoever else a year in advance and work with that actor on that character for a year, and then, you know, fall production, everybody comes back, you cast everybody else, but you already have a Hamlet, or in this case a Richard III, who's off book. Mm-hmm. And has a very strong sense of who Richard III is. And the story is, and it was method acting, that then this person kind of became Richard. Mm-hmm. And whose life just kind of like turned and hit the wall.
Wow.
Yeah. And like, I think he said he went around flea markets selling rugs made out of woven human hair or something.
Oh my
it was
God.
Like how Richard ended up. But like that this person, like that the line between character and person became
very thin.
Very thin.
Now, my Richard III story is I was doing tech for a production of Richard III, and the actor had beautifully memorized this piece. He rarely dropped a line, rarely even paraphrased, and then it was the second night of the show. And he goes out and he's supposed to start Now is the Winter of Our Discontent, one of the most famous monologues in Shakespeare.
Yeah. Can't fuck that one up.
Yeah. He goes out and after nailing it all show, nailing it opening night, nailing it all of Tech Week, he says, "My friends, I know not what to do or say." And then all the tech people in the wings are going, "Now is the winter of our discontent! Now is the winter of our discontent!"
Fuck
and then
off.
He goes, "Now is the winter of our discontent." And then after that, he didn't miss a... But for some reason,
shit. He
could not think of that opening phrase. Yeah. And like, you know, and then fortunately...
Oh.
But he said it completely in character. And so I'm sure like all the Shakespeare fans out there are like, "What the hell just happened?" But anybody who was not
that's
familiar
an
with...
Or that was, that's an interesting interpretation.
Yeah.
Did he sell it that well? But
yeah. But at the same time,
way,
it was like...
Fuck off.
You literally had every single actor, every single tech person, and I'm sure him, just having a coronary. A coronary. Yeah. Didn't that make you sweaty just thinking about that?
Oh, God. I'm having trauma about times. I mean... that I've fucked up. I mean, I haven't. I mean, I did a Reader's Theater thing last summer, but other than that,
I was in a production of West Side Story where Chino's gun didn't go off, so Tony had to be pistol whipped, which made Maria's monologue at the end very interesting.
Yeah, she got bad information.
Yeah.
Oh man, no, that's thankfully my worst flubs have always been in rehearsal, but
yeah,
I could never do it again anyway, so that's, I just know that that door's closed. Memorizing lines, done, not happening.
And I haven't done a theater show since 2016, and I feel, I don't know,
we're talking
maybe
about
somewhat retired, because I really like writing plays, and I just finished the rough draft for a new play, and a couple of my friends have it, and I'm looking for people to read it for me just to get another perspective. And after I finish a rough draft of a play, especially, like, I have this rule where I have to not look at it for a week, even if I want to,
even if I
think of something that's brilliant, I just write it down in a separate notebook, and then maybe I'll put it in later. But I don't do that with poems, but for some reason with plays, I've got to do it. Otherwise, I would
You know, you think about, though, the play is this weirdly intertextual, interpersonal thing. Even if it's just you writing. I mean, the poem, it can be singular and yourself and your experience, and then you always worry about audience, but, you know, you have to create complete people.
Right.
You know, there's a, who shall not be named, there's a playwright I know who actually weirdly can't write straight white men. Just can't write them. Just can't write them as rounded characters at all. And in one of their productions, the straight white man is the main character. And is literally on the stage in every scene just about. And is completely flat and is a complete plot device delivery. Plot delivery device.
Yeah.
You know? And It was so maddening to sit there in the theater and go, this character is not, this is so bad. Like, it was so bad.
Oh no.
Because the main character wasn't a character. So I see that how with a play you have to have, there has to be layers. I mean, listen, the all time, and you know, if you could somehow recombobulate the winds back together, you know. You know, the story about, like, Death of a Salesman, which, kudos to Turner Classic Movies for showing the Dustin Hoffman, Charles Durning, John Malkovich Death of a Salesman on Father's Day this year.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just flipping through it, and I was like, son of a bitch, and just watched it.
That's,
you
like,
know?
The most anti-Father's Day.
Yeah, but, I mean, it was like, hey, showing Mommy Dearest. They also have shown Mommy Dearest on Mother's Day, so we're good.
Yeah.
But I just was like, oh, there's 2.5 hours gone. But supposedly Miller wrote about 1,000 pages of dialogue in that household and burned them all and then wrote the script.
Wow.
He wanted those people to become full people in his mind and see what they would say in dialogue and almost do a method writing as an author.
Oh, yeah. And if
then burned it all and then wrote the actual play.
And if they do it right, that scene where Willie Loman is telling his wife that he just wants his son to love him, and she's like, he already does. If they do it right, I will be a mess. Just a mess after that moment.
Well, when the Red Maskers did that,
yeah.
That was... Wow. Yeah, no, that's a quintessential American play. But anyway, but you know, but that's what Arthur Miller did was, I mean, he created this world.
That or Our Town?
Well, if you're going to go there, do you throw Glass Menagerie in there?
That's tough.
See, I think for me, Our Town... I think, not that Trump ruined Our Town, but I'm doing a panel, actually, at Northeast Modern Language Association Conference about, you know, this problem that we have of, well, not problem, but this way, that our imaginary ideal of America is small-town white Americans.
Yeah.
Those are the true Americans. And people who live in, like, Queens, New York are just this other thing. But our imaginary ideal. And in a way, our town play is as complicated as that play is, and as intense as that play is. And actually, one of the things Kenny Rosinski said, and I think he's right, I mean, is the third act of Our Town the most beautiful thing ever written? Or one of the most beautiful things ever written?
I would say yes.
But it is, you know, every, I mean, yeah, and there's that great Spalding Gray version where he was the stage manager, you know? But what do you do? Again, what do you do with that play realizing, like, it plays, I mean, it invokes the imaginary American ideal, but... You know, that's not America. That's no. There's a whole lot of America that doesn't fit in our town.
That's small town America, maybe.
Yeah, that's small town America. And which is still our imaginary ideal America. It's not urban America, you know.
Mm-hmm. Whereas Death of a Salesman is more, this is probably closer to real life, and real life isn't always pretty, and real life is messy, and
yeah.
Dads cheat on their wives,
and people work.
Sons don't live up to their expectations, and we all manage to love each other anyway, and we all break each other's hearts at the same time.
And people work hard their whole lives and have nothing to show for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and yeah, I mean, all of that is there. First Glass Menagerie, you have, you know, pain in the past and regret and the memory play, and you also have what does it mean to be surrounded by people who are never self-actualized, are never at peace with themselves.
No.
And again, how many people are never at peace with themselves in their lives?
Right.
And they just get old and die, right? Yeah. And that's it. They don't get...
Most people live lives of quiet desperation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, yeah, man, the fuck?
At least I want to be noisy about my desperation.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's... Yeah, no, I'm with you.
So.
So this play is, again... let's wrap up. Let's talk about before we move on to the bottom five. Okay, so where, when, how, what?
Okay. Mad Virginia, part of the Pittsburgh Original Short Play Series, at the Glitterbox Theater, as part of Yinsleck Plays. And this coming Friday, Saturday, July 27th and 28th. 2018, because the internet's forever. It's starting at 7:30.
Glitterbox Theater, and that's on Melwood Avenue in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh, yes.
In Pittsburgh, yes.
Okay, bottom five.
Yeah. Bottom five, Yinsleck Plays. And also, there'll be links, of course, on our webpage. And now it's time for the bottom five. A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature.
Okay.
And today is such a whirlwind that I'm busting out, I think, some new questions no one's heard yet.
Okay.
Because I don't know which questions you asked, and I asked you, me podcast words good now, what questions I asked you the last time you were on the podcast. So, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Number one.
Okay.
Describe a time when you saw someone naked but shouldn't have.
I remember, I don't know why this popped into my head, and oh my God, please forgive me. I was 12 years old. I was in the women's locker room. It was my first day of gym class where you had to, like, take showers at gym class and, like, take off all your clothes. Mm-hmm. And there was this one girl, I won't say her name, who developed way faster than the rest of us. And, like, down below, it was, like, just so much hair. And I was like, ah! And I... looked down and I was like, I don't have that. And then I, like, couldn't take my eyes off it. I can't believe I said that for the internet.
No, I think we've all had that experience.
But I was like, and I had skipped a grade in school, so I was like 11, so I was,
No, I think that's a fairly common experience for people, like somebody either developing faster or just not even knowing what you're supposed to look like, and then... Mm-hmm. You have this funhouse mirror is human biological diversity.
It was crazy.
Yes.
So that's what popped into my head.
Question two then. So that's an early memory. So what is your earliest memory connected to music or art? And or art? What's your first sort of time perhaps that you remember a text, a story, a picture, a sound really captivating you that you can say, wow, that's something?
Well, this is kind of a funny story. When I was about 8, and I'd heard music before that because, like, my mother is a very gifted guitar player and singer and very talented and writes songs. And I can't ever remember a time where I didn't sing. Mm-hmm. And I learned how to read music so young that I don't actually remember having to learn how to read music, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But there was this one time where, like, the worst thing you can make me do is sit down for a long period of time. So a lot of times what my mom would do to punish me is she would find the most boring thing she could find on television, and she would make me watch it for half an hour and sit down. She didn't want to send me to my room because I had my books and I had my,
toys, this is the hottest take I've ever heard about of television as parent, by the way, as parenting figure. And this is a hot take on that. This is innovative.
So she would find something super boring and make me watch it. And so she found this opera on PBS, and that was my punishment. And and as you know, I'm a classically trained singer.
Yeah.
And so she made me watch it for half an hour, and then she came over to me and told me my punishment was over, and I said, no, I want to watch this. And then after that, I made her get me operas out of the public library, and I would watch the videotapes.
Wow.
And it was long story short, don't ever let anybody tell you that crime doesn't pay, because sometimes it does.
Nice. Question 3. Mm-hmm. If you had to choose, would you rather live 100 years in the past or 100 years in the future?
I don't think I'd want to live in the past because, you know, like I said earlier, the whole thing where, like, male family members could commit you for bullshit. So I would have to say probably 100 years in the future.
Okay. 2118,
here I come.
What is your least, question 4, what is your least favorite month?
Least favorite month would have to be January, because all the holidays are over, it's cold, it's frigid, and it feels like it's going to be cold and frigid for forever because the warm weather is not going to be there for 3 or 4 more months.
Getcha. You're almost done. You're almost out of the woods.
Alrighty.
Question 5.
Okay.
What is something most people seem to get, but you just don't?
Oh, sitcoms. I've never been much of a TV watcher. And this aggravates my mother to death about me is like, I don't typically get very emotionally involved in a television show when I watch it, except for Bones. That's the exception. Yeah. I really love that show. Or Scrubs. Scrubs and Bones. Those are the exceptions. Mm. But like, I can watch a show up until, and like 3 minutes from the ending, get up and do something else. And she's like, well, don't you want to see how it ends? And I'm like, eh. And I can do that to a movie too. Like, I can watch 2 hours and 12 minutes of a movie and be disconnected enough from it that 3 minutes from the end, if I have to go to the bathroom, I walk out of the theater and I go to the bathroom.
Wow.
I'm not that way. And that's why I think I've always preferred books over movies, is like, I can read a book and you put it down. I can tinkle. I can come back. It's still where I left it.
Yeah.
So. All right.
So I think that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, Mad Virginia, part of
Pittsburgh Original Short Play Series.
Friday, Saturday, 2018. Friday and Saturday, July 27th and 28th at 7:30 at the Glitterbox Theater in the year of 2018.
Yes.
Okay.
Groovy.
Woo. Links on the website. I think that's about it. Oh, I just said that already. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and Mixcloud. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to Jeanette.
Thank you.
Later, meats.